If you had a playlist that had songs on it that encourage you to keep going, you know, songs that would encourage you not to give up, you know, what would be on that playlist? Would you have Journey's Don't Stop Believing? Maybe Bon Jovi's Living on a Prayer? Maybe you don't like the 80s. Maybe you need a fight song, you know? Take Back Your Life song. Prove You're All Right song. You know, personally, I would take Johnny Cash's cover of I Won't Back Down. That's a good one. Songs are one of those things that really, I mean, they can encourage you to keep going. They can encourage endurance. And there's really a lot of different situations that call for endurance. I mean, you have a hard day at work. You need to endure. You know, you have a fight with a friend or a family member or your spouse. You can't give up on them. You can't quit on them. You're on a long drive, you know, somewhere. You're almost home. You're tired. Okay, if you're really tired, you should pull over. But if not, you gotta keep going. You gotta carry on all the way to the end, right? That's what endurance does. So your attitude plays a big part in whether or not you're gonna keep going. I mean, if you don't think you can make it, you probably won't. And if you don't think it's worth going on, you're probably not gonna keep going. And sometimes there's just too much pressure, you know, pressure from your circumstances. Before we had taken our kids to Disney World when we were in Florida, that seemed like a lot of pressure. I mean, you spend all this money for one day. And I mean, it's gotta all work out that day. I mean, if there's bad weather, too bad. You know? If there's ridiculously crowded parks, you know, too bad. If that ride that you were hoping to be on or to take your kids on is broken down, that's just the way it goes. But we lived in Florida. We lived there. And they had these things called Florida passes. And we were able to afford them at first. Not for long. But the thing is, that takes the pressure off, right? Because you can always come back. Not at peak times or the weekends. But you could always, there was always another day where you could come back. So if it was raining or if it was excessively hot or if there were everybody in the universe there at the same day, you know, that's okay. You could always come back another day. I always felt bad for the families that was not true for. You know, we'd be riding over on the monorail. I remember one dad had a laminated card that was the plan for the day. I mean, that's what you did. If it was your one shot, you had a plan that we're going to make sure and squeeze out every ounce of joy you could get out of the experience. But you know, with a laminated plan, I'm not sure that was going to happen. I mean, job number one was have a nice time. What happens if any of the things on that list don't happen? I mean, it's laminated. What are you going to do then? But, you know, for us, if our day wasn't great at Disney, you know, we could just make the best of it because it wasn't the only thing that was true of our Disney experience. We had a future that we could still look forward to. And that's the way it is with us, isn't it, as Christians? This life is not all there is. You do not only live once. So you're not trying to squeeze every ounce of joy out of this life. You can keep going when things are bad. When everybody seems against you, when your lives aren't the success that you imagine they would be, you can keep going. But sometimes you need a reminder. Sometimes you need somebody or something that tells you all your eggs aren't in this basket. And so maybe that song tells you to carry on, right? Tells you there'll be peace when you're done. Lay your weary head to rest. Don't you cry no more. You know, something like that. Maybe it's like the song here in this passage. The major goal of this song, I think, is to encourage God's people to endure, to keep going. It's a song for endurance. Now, at the very outset of it, it's not clear exactly what should be included in this song. I'm just taking the whole chapter as the song. And in it, there's this back and forth between two groups in each of these sections. So, you know, there's a strong city and a lofty city of the righteous and the wicked, God's people and his enemies, those who take cover and then what is uncovered. You have these back and forth. Now, there's not just one way to divide a song or a chapter, but the way that I was looking at this passage, I kind of saw a pattern that has bookends. So you'll have these repetitions at the beginning and the end. And then you also have, again, these comparisons that are made. And so in verses 1 through 7, there's a comparison between two cities and a journey to one particular city. And then in verses 8 through 13, it centers on these two kinds of responses. And then verses 14 through 19 emphasizes two different destinies. And then finally, you have these two types of cover. And so that's how I'm dividing up this song for endurance. Two cities, two responses, two destinies, and two covers. And so Isaiah starts it off in verse 1 by saying, in that day, this song will be sung in the land of Judah. We know Isaiah's vision, this book, is for Judah and Jerusalem. But starting in chapter 13, he started focusing on the nations. And it was clear in this section that we've been covering that God's people will expand to include the nations. So the greatest nations of Isaiah's day, Isaiah prophesies in chapter 19 that one day they're going to become God's people. And then in the chapter we just looked at, the banquet described here is for all peoples. But it was also a banquet on this mountain, on Mount Zion. And Isaiah already told us in chapter 2 that one day the nations are going to stream into Zion. And so the fact that this song is sung in that day in the land of Judah, that doesn't mean only Judeans are singing it. It's all God's people, past and present. So we get to sing this song. So like Augustine and Dickens, before Isaiah, Isaiah sings about these two cities, a tale of two cities. He mentions a strong city first, and this is the city that's experienced God's salvation. So he describes salvation as making it strong, that he is the Lord, and it pictures a city and salvation really as these walls and bulwarks, so that these are the defenses of the city. The walls are intact. The bulwark, that may be like a small wall around the other one, or maybe a raised part that's also another defense, but it just means that God is protecting the city by salvation. It sounds a lot like Luther's hymn, you know, a mighty fortress is our God, a bulwark never failing. And here it's God's salvation specifically. That's what's dependable. So in the end, it's going to be very evident, it's going to be fully evident, God has saved his people. So in that picture, this city with strong walls and bulwarks, Isaiah calls out, he says, open the gates that the righteous nation may, that keeps faith, may enter in. So the righteous nation is the one who has access to this. But what's the basis of that right to enter? What is that righteousness? In the Old Testament, righteous doesn't always mean, or doesn't even often mean, what you've done, your performance. It very often has to do with your status. So even in Isaiah, you have in Isaiah 53, the suffering servant who gives that status of righteous to the many. He makes the many righteous. They're not righteous inherently, but they're made right with God. So that's what we can see, that this is the nation who are made up of people who are right with God. They're in right standing with him, right relationship with him. But at the same time, that status has a behavior that fits with it. So the kind of person here is more literally, they're the person who keeps faithfulnesses. I know that's not correct, but that's the idea. You have these multiple instances, multiple opportunities to demonstrate that you're faithful to God. And so the person who is right with God is loyal to him. In verse 3, it's a good verse. It tells you the result of this situation. So the person who's right with God, who's loyal to God, they enter the city of God's salvation in the end, and they can experience peace. But not just peace. Actually, the text reads peace, peace. It's translated perfect peace. Not just peace, it's peace, peace. It's the greatest instance of peace, greatest instance of tranquility that only God can provide. And then there's a play on words with two similar sounding words, and Isaiah basically says that there's this stable thinking that ensures this stable peace. The word for mind here, it's the same word used in Genesis 6:5 for the formation of evil thoughts. Here, it's the formation of thoughts that are supported. They're secure. So these are not thoughts that are vacillating. They're not going back and forth. These are thoughts that are stable. And the reason they're stable is that the person is trusting in the Lord. So when you experience salvation, your mind can be at peace. You can rest because you know who the Lord is. That's what gives security to your mind. So it's in this state of perfect peace that we'll experience fully in the end, in glory. But Isaiah is encouraging us even now to have this same attitude. So he says in verse 4, trust in the Lord forever, for the Lord God is an everlasting rock. And this word, if you notice, there's three different words that are in all caps. There's three different times that the divine name is used. Twice in its normal form, Yahweh, once in a shortened form, Yah. So he's saying, trust in Yahweh, on and on. Even Yah. Yahweh, a rock of ages. So there is no expiration date on the security that God provides. He's a rock of ages. He's that giant rock that, you know, the wind comes, the rain comes, and that rock still stands. So he lasts forever. So Isaiah is saying we shouldn't just wait to the end to trust in him. We can trust in him now. Now, what makes it hard for us to trust in God are all the different people around us who are opposed to God. That's what intimidates us, right? The people that aren't on God's side, that cause us to take our eyes off of God, off of that security. And there's all these important people, all these very big and mighty people around us that they're not on our side. They're not on God's side. And it seems like they're in charge. And so Isaiah makes it clear they're not going to last. He even emphasizes it by repeating it. And he says the reason is for the Lord, has humbled the inhabitants of the height, the lofty city. He says it like it's already happened. And then he goes on to kind of speak more as the future. He says, he lays it low to the ground, casts it to the dust. You can't get a greater extreme, can you, than the heights, the lofty city, and the ground, the low ground, the dust. So that city is really the world city, right? We already saw that in the last chapter. This is the world that's united against their creator. They're not actually lofty. That word really just is talking about their pride. This is what they think. It's the same word used in chapter 2 for the same results that are mentioned there. Those who exalt themselves, those who say that they're high, say they're important, they're going to be brought low. They're going to be brought back down to earth. And really, what this is directed to is not just some humbling experience, but this is a reference to death, especially with the words to the ground and to the dust. From the dust we were taken, to the dust we returned, as Ecclesiastes puts it. And then verse 6 adds to that picture. And all those who are opposed to God, they seem important, seem intimidating, but in the end, they're going to be under our feet. That's what he says in verse 6. The foot tramples it. The feet of the poor, the steps of the needy. So you got the arrogant on one end of the spectrum and the poor and the needy on the other end, which goes along with what Jesus says in the Beatitudes, the poor in spirit. Those who are insignificant, even if just in their own estimation, they're not putting themselves up, not lifting themselves and exalting themselves. So this is very much like what Jesus says in the Gospels, right? Who's on top will be down beneath. Who is first will be last. The last will be first. So this is where we're headed. We're headed towards this strong city. And verse 7 describes the path to that city. It's right over the lofty city. We're walking on the demolished lofty city towards this final future. And so he describes that path as level. It's a word that could be translated straight or direct. So it's not saying it's an easy path. It's not saying it's a glamorous path. Actually, the word for way here is a wagon track. It's not a glamorous path, but it's direct. It's taken us straight for this city. And that's why we can endure. That's why we can keep going, because we know the way that we're going, this life that we're living, is headed in the right direction. So here we are. We're in this world. Like Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians, we're not the smartest or the strongest or the noblest. Everybody in the lofty city's laughing at us because we're leaving. We're heading to another city. We're going in a different direction. That's because we don't trust them. We trust the Lord. We know this lofty city's all talk. We're like Bunyan's pilgrim, trusting in what God says is true. The Lord God, the rock of ages. So we're not choosing the path everyone else is choosing. But as we keep our eyes on our destination, as we keep our eyes on that strong city, you know, we can rest in peace. We can have peace. Because we know we're headed to the right city. That's not all you see here in this passage. There's also these two different responses. You know, people don't respond to life the same way. So Isaiah first talks about the way God's people respond to life. And he keeps that analogy going in verse 8 of walking along a path. So as you keep walking on this path, we see this path, we see life as governed by God. That's what these judgments are talking about. God is the one who determines the way that the world should be. And so that's the way we think about it. We're not just trying to satisfy our own desires, our own natural sinful desires. We're waiting for the Lord. We have desires that are greater than that. Deeper desires, the desire of our soul. And that desire is for God's greatness. That's what he describes here. The words your name and remembrance. It's talking about the goal of our creation, the goal of our salvation. We are here to enjoy God's greatness. So instead of trying to make a name for ourselves, instead of trying to do something or be somebody that can be remembered, we want to spread God's renown. That's what it's describing. And then verse 9 describes the desire that we have, this deep desire. It says it's in my soul, my spirit within me. And it uses these verbs. He yearns for the Lord and earnestly seeks him. So Isaiah is here being very personal, but he's describing the way we all should look to God. We want God in this world. We know that God's governing the world. Again, these are his judgments. And so when his judgments are seen, the inhabitants of the world learn righteousness. The words righteousness and judgment, that's just a way that the prophets very often describe the world rightly ordered. So the idea is very much like Jesus' prayer, right? When we see God's order, when we see his righteousness, when we see his judgments, we see the way that he orders the world, we learn from it. We live in light of it. And so this desire is really just like Jesus' prayer that he taught his disciples. We want the Father's name to be honored, to be hallowed. We want his kingdom to come, his will to be done on earth as it is in heaven. Now that's what we're waiting for. We're waiting expectantly for that. That's what we're longing for. But that's not the way that everybody responds here, does it? So God shows favor to the wicked, and what happens? Well, we know he's done that. I mean, he causes the rain to fall on the just and the unjust. He causes the sun to shine on the wicked and the good. And so he's been gracious to the wicked, but that hasn't caused them to learn righteousness, have it? I mean, they haven't learned God's righteous way. So verse 10 says, if favor is shown to the wicked, he does not learn righteousness. The world's designed for uprightness. He deals corruptly. You know, we saw in Proverbs the way that God didn't just design order in the atoms and in the cells. He designed order for how you live. So he designed an upright behavior, and the wicked respond in a crooked way. And that's because they don't see God's greatness. They don't see his majesty. So that's what our lives are centered on. It's on God's greatness, and they don't even see that. And so in light of that, Isaiah has this response or his reply. It's a very passionate reply in the next three verses. All of them begin with, O Lord. And so he says, O Lord, your hand is lifted up, but they do not see it. Now, it could be that it's lifted up because it's about to take action in judgment. But also in Isaiah 13 and Isaiah 49, you see the hand used to signal people. And so it could be that what this is saying is that God's signaling for people and they're not seeing it. Either way, they're not looking to God, not paying attention to God. They're missing it. And so Isaiah prays that they would see it. He prays that they would see God's zeal for his people. So they're not paying attention to God. They're not treating him the way that they should. They're rejecting him. They don't give him the time of day. And Isaiah says they need to see God's great concern for his people. In the end, that's what they're going to see. And what that's going to do is when they realize that the creator of the universe cares this passionately about his people, they'll be ashamed of the fact that they ignored him. And then Isaiah has these very uncomfortable words where he affirms this fiery judgment. Isaiah understands that they deserve this judgment. I mean, if God has zeal for us, isn't it right for us to have zeal for him? This kind of passion that says we care when people aren't treating God the right way. We abhor the way that he's treated. All that God's done for humanity, and this is how they treat him. So if we truly want God's glory above all else, if we long for his kingdom, if we want the world to be the way that he wants the world to be, then we can understand why everyone who poses that reality deserves to be judged. If we really understand the one, we can understand the other. So you see violence and hatred and mistreatment and greed and deprivation and abuse, and we know it all it comes from the same thing. It all comes from living without God as at the center. It's not simply a matter of humans doing things in the most logical way or in the most, it's not about just this human natural way of doing things. It's about not having God at the center. So if God's glory is our purpose, the reason for our life, then we understand why rejecting him deserves judgment. That is not to say in any way that we think we're better. And the problem is that we can have this idea that, well, since we're not any better, we can't have that feeling. We pit those two facts against themselves. You know, we say, well, but by the grace of God, I'd be the same way. So how can I have that sense of that deserves judgment? Both of those really can be true. And that's what you see. Isaiah really does show that. You know, after this fiery prayer, he then responds about what is it that gives them this peace? He says, well, O Lord, you ordain peace for us. As opposed to the fiery destruction God's determined for those who continue in their rebellion, he's determined that his people would experience this peace, this tranquility, the world as it's always intended to be. And then he says, the reason that he's ordained this peace is because you have indeed done for us all our works. Now, he says they're our works, so these are things that God's people has done. They've done these works. But he also says that God has accomplished them. So this is actually one of those paradoxical statements that you have in the Bible. You know, how can God do everything we've done? Sounds like a contradiction. It also sounds very much like Philippians 2, 12, and 13. Paul told the Philippians, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you both to will and to work for his good. We're to work our salvation, put it to use, but we're only doing that, we're doing that in the fear of God because God is in us. He's at work in us. And that work is what causes us to want to do that and even to be able to do that. And so this is Isaiah's version of that. We can't take credit for the good that we do. We're responsible. We have to do that. But at the end of the day, we look and we see that God is the one that produces that in our lives. So it's all of grace. Verse 13 then continues to focus on God's sovereignty. And Isaiah takes time to think about all the instances where it seemed like other people were in charge, you know, like Pharaoh. All the times in the book of Judges where there's these foreign rulers, or most recently with Assyria. And Isaiah says, that wasn't the whole picture. There, even though there were other lords, we were paying attention, or we are remembering you. We see you as the Lord of Lords. So it's this glory, this sovereignty, That is what we should see in prophecy. Prophecy is supposed to give us a glimpse of the God who is glorious, the God who really is in charge. It is not supposed to lead us to pedantic arguments about how it all fits together. It's supposed to lead us to this yearning for God's glory, this desire for everybody to see God's greatness. That's what it leads us to. It's supposed to keep our eyes on our sovereign God so that we wait for him instead of trying to live our best life now. So if you're going to keep going, if you're going to endure, how you respond to your experience is going to, it's going to have an effect on whether you're enduring or not. If you're not paying attention to God in life, you're not going to endure. We can endure in this life when everything in this life revolves around God. So we head towards this right city with this right response. And then there's this third contrast in this chapter about how we endure. There are these two destinies. Then you see them in verses 14 through 19. And he starts with the destiny of those who oppose God. He says, they are dead. They will not live. They are shades. They will not arise. To that end, you have visited them with destruction and wiped out all remembrance of them. So we live for God's remembrance. We live for his name. His name endures. Those who oppose God will not endure. They will not be remembered. Be devastated, wiped out. Now, verse 14 is not saying there is no resurrection of the wicked. We know in Daniel 12:2, there is a resurrection. Book of Revelation, same thing. There's a resurrection for both the righteous and the wicked. But the immediate referent to they here is the Lord's in verse 13. So this is focused on the fact that those who oppose God are not going to be in charge of the world forever. Again, Isaiah is so certain of this, he describes it as though it's already happened. There's no future for the wicked on the earth. They do experience a second life, as it were, but it immediately results in second death, according to Revelation. So the point here is that they have no lasting claim on the world. They die and exist only as shades or bodiless shadows. They're not going to be raised to this resurrection life. They only have a resurrection of everlasting contempt. So that's the destiny of those who rebel against God. And it's contrasted with the destiny of God's people in verse 15. So in contrast with destroying the enemies of God who'd ruled, the Lord has increased the nation. Isaiah repeats that for emphasis. So those other lords aren't remembered, but the Lord, Yahweh, he is honored. He's glorified. He is remembered. So how has he increased the nation? Well, the end of the verse says, you have enlarged all the borders of the land. Micah, Isaiah's contemporary, said something very similar. In Micah 7:11, he says, in that day, the boundary shall be far extended. So what are they talking about? Well, we know about God's promise to Abraham, specifically to Abraham's offspring, which was the promised land. But the Lord went beyond that in Genesis 22:17. So he told Abraham there, your offspring shall possess the gate of his enemies, not just the land, but even more than that. That seems to be the reason why Paul says in Romans 4:13 that the promise to Abraham and his offspring was that he would be heir of the world. The promise was not simply this little tract of land in Israel, but the world. And that was even evident to Abraham. Now, the funny thing about the word offspring is you can either understand that it's talking about one specific person or many. And it becomes very clear that prophecy there in Genesis 22 is about the one, the Messiah. So in the promise to David's Lord in Psalm 110:1, it says, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Just good connection with Genesis 22:17. Now, the promised land has borders, right? So in Exodus 23:31, it says the borders to the promised land are from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, from the wilderness to the river. Well, Isaiah comes along and he says, well, for the Messiah, the promised king, he's going to take possession from sea to sea, same language, and from the river to the ends of the earth. There is an expansion of borders that Isaiah describes. And it's going to eventually cover new heavens, new earth, everything. So what Isaiah is promising in verse 15, it fits in line with that promise. But the question is, why mention that here? Why talk about that specifically in this context where he's been giving these oracles to the nations? Well, later on in Isaiah, he explains why the border has to expand. He says in Isaiah 54, 2 and 3 that he describes the land as a tent that has to be stretched out further and further so it can possess the nations. Again, that fits with the progressive revelation in the Bible. Earlier, God promised that he was going to make Abraham's descendants as numerous as the dust of the earth, as the stars in the heavens, as the sand on the edge of the sea. He passed those promises on to Isaac and Jacob, but he did something interesting with Jacob. Not only would Jacob be a nation, but he promised that he would be a nation and an assembly of nations, a kahal, a church of nations, you could even say. So the mystery in the Old Testament is not at all that the Gentiles have no connection to the promises of God. The mystery was how. Because from the beginning, God intended to bless the nations, and then slowly he shows that there's an integration here, that the nations are included. Now, that mystery, how it's resolved, isn't fully explained until Christ. But the fact is that this is the glorious future, not just for Israel, but for us. Now, it's not what Israel was experiencing, and so as soon as he mentions that, he immediately kind of laments the current situation. So in verse 16, which is a little confusing, a lot of ideas about what it's saying. It uses a word here that's never used for humans. This is the only place it's used for humans. It's translated sought. Same word is translated visited in verse 14. That's the way you usually translate it. Well, the main idea to the term of visiting usually is where God basically in essence is pictured as doing an inspection. So he's coming to inspect people, and based on that inspection, he's either going to reward them, punish them, or discipline them based on his relationship and based on what he finds. So it seems like maybe we should take this verb in the passive sense. There's a way to take it passively. And so then the verse is saying that God's people were in distress when God visited them in discipline. And then the second verse describes them praying, maybe a whisper of prayer that's an intense prayer. Or maybe it's saying that they're under this pressure. And under that pressure of discipline, they're humbled. Isaiah goes on to describe the distress they're experiencing, and he compares it to pregnancy. I always find it interesting when men do this, right? We're just taking a guess, right? But you can see the intensity of a pregnant woman in labor. So he says, like a pregnant woman who writhes and cries out in her pangs when she is near to giving birth, so were we because of you, O Lord. So it's the Lord's discipline that they're feeling that causes this intense pain. It's like being in labor, he says. And then he explains what's so disturbing about that. Because in these prophecies, Israel and Judah, they understood themselves to have a role in this deliverance. So they very often thought, okay, as we stand up to these rulers, then that's going to be part of what God does in bringing about our salvation. And that's not what happened. They're standing up to the Assyrians. It's not what's happening. So they observed this distress, this labor that they're going through, and they said it didn't do anything. It was like they'd given birth to wind. Like the other end of it, normally in a pregnancy, you can endure that discipline, endure that labor because there's something good on the other side of it. And Isaiah's saying there's nothing good that came out of this. It says that they accomplished no deliverance in the earth. And the inhabitants of the world have not fallen. Instead, God's people had fallen. People had died. And so it seems like the concern of verse 19, why 19 comes up, is because even though a remnant is going to survive, that's the promise that Isaiah has, they're going to just survive God's discipline. But what about the many who died before that? I mean, is that going to be true for Isaiah and the people that he's giving this message to? So how are they to endure if they're not enduring to these promises? And so Isaiah gives this amazing promise from God. It's so amazing, many people try to deny that this is what Isaiah is saying, that he's actually talking about resurrection here. So many think, oh, he can't be talking about that this early. They have a view of the world that says, you know, hey, this is how religion happens. It kind of slowly, ideas kind of emerge slowly and fit with the surrounding culture. And so they say either Isaiah didn't really say this, and it's really much later, or it's really not talking about resurrection. Now, there's no reason to take this as not a part of Isaiah. This is not something that you need to say, well, maybe Isaiah didn't write verse 19. It fits perfectly here. So then they say, well, this has to be metaphorical. You know, it's talking about political resurrection. Well, here's the thing about metaphors. When you do a metaphor, it's an abstract idea, right? That's based on something concrete. You're making a comparison with something concrete. So you don't start with the abstract metaphor, the comparison, without the reality. If you're going to compare something to resurrection, you have to already believe that there is such a thing. So we wouldn't agree with their evolutionary version of the way that the Bible works. We believe that the Bible is actual revelation. That God, that he actually spoke through Isaiah. Same God who gave life, the same God who takes it away, is this God who can give it back. And so, this is the eternal God, who, as he speaks through Isaiah, knows what he's going to do in Jerusalem 700 some years later. He's going to raise Christ from the dead. That's in the mind of the one inspiring this right now. And so Isaiah says something more clearly than it has ever been said before this. And there are instances where it moves in this direction, but Isaiah states it clearly. He says, "Your dead shall live." Again, that is not a promise just for the old covenant people. So hear that again. Your dead shall live. Did you hear that? Your dead shall live. Your dead shall live. Their bodies shall rise. The word bodies there is a reference to a body that has died. This is bodily resurrection. This is resurrection life. It's only true for those who trust in the Lord, who endure in their faith. They will live. Just like Jesus says, whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. So Isaiah then responds, I mean, as he's getting this revelation as well, he responds by telling the dead, "You who dwell in the dust, awake and sing for joy." Those who are exalted or lofty, they're cast to the dust. But those who dwell in the dust, who belong to the Lord, they can awake. And we know awake, that's a sleep is a way that you could compare death to. So to awake is to experience resurrection. So why can they awake and sing for joy? Well, Isaiah, he describes this dew that refreshes them. You know, I've said this before, in a semi-arid climate, the dew is really, really important to keep these plants on the ground alive. But this is not just any dew. It's the dew of light, and light is another image for life. And the dead are in darkness, but the living are in the light. And so this is an image, a way of saying how God is going to carry out this resurrection and he's going to give life to the dead again. Now, the wording, the last part there, it's translated as though the earth is giving birth. That's not the normal way to say that. The more literal wording is the earth will cause the shades to fall or the shadows to fall. It's a normal word for falling. And it is the same word for shades given in verse 14. So you continue to have these repetitions. Now, it is possible that this is a way to describe birth. There's a way for falling to be a description of birth in Isaiah's day. But I think John Oswalt has probably the better idea of viewing this. It views the earth as though it's holding these shades, these shadows, so that they can't escape. Kind of like an animal holding prey in its mouth. And this is saying that the Lord makes the earth drop its prey so that it falls away from the earth. And that's the description of the dead. So again, it's a description of resurrection. Our destiny, it's not destruction and never being remembered. We believe and look for the resurrection of the dead and the life of the world to come. That's our hope. That's what we look forward to. That's why we can keep going. This life is not the end. We don't have to have our best life now. We don't have to get all we can now. We don't only live once. We believe in the resurrection. That's why we don't drown in our baptisms, right? We come out of the water. Lee is especially thankful for that, most recently. Right? We come out. Why do we come out? Because we believe in the resurrection. We believe that the third day Jesus rose again and ascended into heaven. We believe he shall come again. And Paul says in Philippians 3, when he does that, he is going to transform our lowly body to be like his glorious body. So we believe Isaiah's promise here. We're headed toward the good city. We are responding in the good way, and we have this good destiny to look forward to. And then there's one final way that this song teaches us to endure. It's through a comparison between two covers. So the last two verses, you have Isaiah describing the end again, but he's describing how you get there, really. And he says there are those who take cover, and then there are things that are uncovered. So he gives his people direction here to endure. He says in verse 20, come, my people, enter your chambers and shut your doors behind you. Hide yourselves for a little while until the fury has passed by. And God's fury, his indignation, is because of sin. The same word for fury is used by David to say it comes because of sin. He says that in Psalm 38. And this word also for fury is a word that Asaph uses to describe the plagues in Psalm 78. You remember the plagues? The last plague, the death of the firstborn, also described God as passing by in chapter 12, just like the language here. And you remember that the people were told to stay in their houses. So Moses said in Exodus 12, 22, none of you shall go out of the door of his house until morning. That's what's being described here, a very similar scene where Israel's told, take shelter, go inside your house. And implicitly, there's a promise here that they're going to be protected. Just as Israel had to endure that last plague, but were protected in it, that's what's being described here. So Isaiah's saying, you can keep going. You're going to have to hunker down, but you can endure. And then there's this encouragement in the face of all the injustice that God's people had and have experienced. The armies, the battles, the ways that Judah had been treated, the losses they'd experienced, it's all going to be brought to light. Mistreatment that you experience is going to be brought to light. So not only is the earth forced to let go of its hold on the dead who are the people of God, but the earth's also going to reveal the truth about how they got there. It's going to reveal the truth about how they died. Isaiah says, the earth will disclose the bloodshed on it and will no more cover its slain. So the people of God can take cover knowing that the earth is soon going to uncover all that they'd experienced, all that the enemies of God had done to them. So there is a day. There's a day coming when the people who are on top are going to be brought low. It's a day when those who oppose God are going to be forced to face him. Those who continue to rebel are going to be judged. Now, we are no less sinners than those who will be judged. I mean, that's clear in this passage. God's people are being disciplined for their sin. So their righteousness wasn't based on their obedience. It was based on the obedience of the suffering servant. Makes the many righteous. So everyone in this passage is a sinner. The only question is, which kind of sinner? Now, are you one who refuses to turn? Or are you one who humbles yourself under the mighty hand of God now? See, the fact is, God's going to cut us down to size at some point, but he can do that now. He can humble your heart now. Is he doing that? Do you see God's glory? Do you see this love that he displayed in how he's taking care of the punishment for sin that we deserve? Are you taking cover in the rock of ages? Or is there going to be no cover for you in the end? Now is the time to trust in Christ. And for all of us who are trusting in Christ, what this song is doing, again, is encouraging us to keep going. It's telling us, hey, the end is right around the corner. It's near. It's imminent. But you can keep going. You will make it to the strong city. Not by your own strength. Everything that we accomplish, he has done for us. But there is a banquet that is close, and we get to enjoy that banquet. And so not only do we encourage each other with songs like this, but we encourage each other to keep going by just that little bit of taste of the banquet that we have, that we repeatedly do. We call the Lord's Supper. This is when we remember what Christ did for us. This is what he did so that we can enjoy the strong city, so that we can enjoy the banquet. This is what he did so that we can have confidence in the resurrection. We get this little, very little taste of the banquet. It's to point us forward, even as it points us back. But we do need to remember what this is that we're doing. Jesus established this for local churches. He established this for people who have committed to be a part of a church family, who are gathering consistently together. So this is not, as many, many Christians in our day think, that this is just some individualistic thing that makes you feel closer to God. This is a family exercise where we encourage each other. So through baptism, we affirm everyone's faith. That's what we're doing through baptism. We're affirming the faith of other believers. Through the membership process that we have, we are affirming that person's faith. And then with the members, we repeatedly reaffirm our faith as we take this together. That is the idea of taking it together, where we're saying as we do that, we believe each other, that we are all believing the same thing. So this is, it's why it's a family activity. You should normally do this with a church where you're a member. Now, we do allow visitors to do that, provided you're a baptized member of another church where you usually do this. And we do want that church to be the one that believes the same gospel that we believe and preach here. So if that's true, then you can join with us. If not, I'd encourage you to talk to me afterwards about it. And we'd love for you to join us in this. So would the men come forward to administer the Lord's Supper? And while you wait, I'd encourage you to examine yourselves, to consider, are you enduring? Are you loyal? Are you faithful? And if you think, well, no, I've failed in this or that area, that's not a reason to not take. It's a reason to confess and to enjoy that we have this relationship, not on the basis of our performance, but on the basis of what he's done for us. So I'd encourage you to confess and celebrate with us. Join me in a word of prayer. Father, again, we are so thankful for the encouragement that you give us, the hope that we have. And it's not a hope that is, well, we're questioning whether it will happen. We believe this will happen, that we're looking forward to it. We're expectant. We're waiting for it. We're so thankful for the confidence we can have, especially because you raised your son from the dead. So help us to be encouraged by your word, by these promises, that we would endure. And even as we take this communion, that encourages us to look back at what you've done for us in Christ, that we would also look forward all the more to the day when we will actually have this meal with Christ, with you in glory. together, a feast, a banquet. Help us to look back and look forward by your Spirit. Amen.